Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
News comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities to help ensure a brighter future for America's children. More information is available at aecf.org.
From NPR News, I'm Mike Moen. The Hennepin County Sheriff's Office says an inmate who escaped from the county jail in downtown Minneapolis earlier this morning has been captured. The Sheriff's Office says the 57-year-old Hopkins man escaped from the jail about 7 a.m., prompting a search of a nearby parking ramp and a major police presence downtown. Michael Frank Simon was booked into the jail in September for financial transaction card fraud and a State Department of Corrections hold order for burglary. More cities are weighing their options for ways to treat sewage and see potential in selling nutrients to farmers to fertilize their crops. Jeremy Guest, an engineering professor at the University of Illinois, is visiting the Twin Cities this week to encourage communities to explore the possibilities. He says if wastewater utilities could recover resources and market them, it could give cities new sources of revenue to maintain their infrastructure. Meanwhile, he says wastewater treatment plants would discharge less of the nutrients that cause algae blooms into waterways.
It enables us to actually align goals for financial viability of our utilities and environmental sustainability.
Guest says the newest wastewater byproducts are made into a crystal substance similar to synthetic fertilizers that farmers use to boost corn and soybean yields. But he says the wastewater technology industry has more work to do to engage farmers and ensure a market for the alternative fertilizer. Sanford Health is set to open its new $21 million clinic in Sioux Falls. The company says the clinic will bring pharmacy, acute care services, and behavioral health care to the growing west side of that city. And in sports, the Minnesota Timberwolves are in action tonight. They play host to the San Antonio Spurs. The Timberwolves beat Cleveland in Cleveland on Monday evening. Statewide forecast for the rest of today, we'll continue to see snow moving from west to east across much of the state. Temperatures today ranging from the low 20s in northern Minnesota and the low 30s in the southern half of the state. Cloudy skies with snow approaching the Twin Cities, 24 degrees. And in Duluth right now, it's fair and 18. This is NPR News. It's 11:06.
Good morning. This is NPR News, and I'm Brant Williams in for Carrie Miller. According to Pew Research, more and more Americans describe themselves as being non-affiliated with any particular religious faith. But that doesn't mean that people are running away from ritual. This morning, I want to talk about ritual without the religious dogma. Why do we create and partake in rituals? Do rituals only have to mark really big occasions like weddings and funerals, or can the daily mundane events in our lives be ritualized, like making our morning coffee? Have you ever tried to create your own ritual to mark a special occasion, like for welcoming a new pet into your home? I hope you'll join our conversation this morning by calling 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. And you can always reach me on Twitter at BrantNPR. Remember, there's a silent D in my first name. My guest this hour is Yeltia Gordon-Lennox. She is a psychotherapist and author of Crafting Secular Ritual. She's a practical guide. She joins us this morning from Geneva, Switzerland. Yeltia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Great. Yeltia, first I want to start by, let's first define some terms. I want to make sure that we're speaking correctly when we use the terms ritual, ceremony, and tradition. Can these be used interchangeably?
let's back up a little bit. In the early definitions of ritual were under a subcategory of religion. Mm-hmm. And secular was also a subcategory of religion. And for many academic in universities, for example, a ritual is under ritual studies or under religion department. And many publishers also put ritual under the religion department. That's because the early ideas of concepts of ritual were really related, like you said, to tradition and to ceremony.
Okay.
And there was also this sort of aspect of them and us. It was a way of studying other cultures, and it came to us rather, it took us a little while to figure out that we also had rituals. But the kind that you're talking about, with making your coffee and welcoming a pet into the home, I think are fascinating, because it shows that our idea, our concept of ritual, like, jumped off the academic's desk and hopped onto marquees for cosmetics and spas and coffee and things like that. So it's, I think that following the current trends corresponds much better to general practice of ritual, that it's not a subcategory of religion, but perhaps if there's a category above it, it would be there's ritual that's religious, there's ritual that's secular, there's consumer rituals, there are lots of different kinds.
Okay. And that's what I want to be able to kind of talk about when we, for this conversation this morning. And so that was very helpful to get those definitions and to kind of get more of the background. And so my other question along that line is, just help us understand, if you have seen, when that split between the ritual for religious purposes and the ritual for secular purposes, was there ever like a big historical split somewhere, or is that, or if we always had this, both of these types, the religious ritual and the secular?
Well, according to some scholars like Murray Douglas, secular is a worldview, just like religious could be a worldview, or even consumerism could be a worldview. And the idea of secular being something new is not really, but it's not something I hold to. I think it's always been there, just like religious or spiritual. Religious institutions are rather new. In fact, they came with urbanization.
Sure.
When we had all color institutions, like political institutions. Before that, we had hunter-gather groups, which gathered in small groups, and much like some of the local religions in that we still have, like Shintoism, it's a more of a directed to a spirit world.
But that's very interesting. I'm wondering if are there of these secular rituals that, as you say, the secular kind of predated the institution of religion? Is it fair to say that when religion was instituted, as we urbanized, that religions kind of appropriated some of the early rituals that hunter-gatherers in other societies practice regularly?
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Oh, well, I'll let you expand on that, because I'm sure you can say it better than I did. Give us some examples
of
that.
That's what I hold, that institutions did. They sort of appropriated ritual making, the process of making. And when that happened, the three-part process of ritual making changed. Before there was a planning phase and a creating phase and then the realizing phase. And with institutionalization of ritual making, or it's taking it away, in fact, the institutionalization of ritual, particularly ceremonial and religious ritual or political ritual, we took away the creative phase, which made things a lot easier for us somehow. But it also took it took the creative process away from us.
Yeah, and that's also another fascinating part of this conversation that I want to get into as well, is the personalizing and making ritual have some meaning to us, I'll use this example of I don't know if our listeners have ever been to, say, a funeral or a wedding that was held in a church, and it didn't seem as personal to the people who are the subject of those particular rituals. I'm wondering if you feel the same way, if the institutionalization of rituals have just kind of taken this out of the hands of people and maybe has caused it to lose some meaning, the actual ritual lose some meaning for people.
I would take it in a little bit different direction and say that it depends on the, like you talked about the subject, that you mean like the deceased or the couple that's getting married,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. In my book, I talk about a ritual profile. If the person is religious, practicing, like more than once or twice a year. And they die. And there's a funeral that's a traditional, conventional religious funeral. Those who come, even if the person is not spoken about very much, those who are present will find that person there because it reflects their values and their practice and sure. what was important to them and the people that were important, the place that was important to them. If, on the other hand, that wasn't the case and their ritual profile is not institutional but, say, secular or alternative, or, which makes it even more complicated, distance, that's the people that go to, you know, to services about twice a year. These people, if they have a religious ceremony, a religious funeral, or a religious marriage, a wedding ceremony, it's not going to fit. And so it's more a question of what is the ritual profile of the person that's at the center of the ceremony yeah. than is there a problem with the institution? Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. Thanks for, and I'm pretty sure we're going to have as we, I'm going to get to some callers here in a few minutes. People may also have some examples along those lines as well. I just want to let people know, my name is Brant Williams. You're listening to NPR News this hour. We're talking about secular rituals. You just heard from Yeltia Gordon-Lennox. And right now we're also joined by phone by Kathy Davies. She's a lecturer and managing director of Life Design Lab at Stanford University in Fremont, California. Kathy, welcome to our conversation.
Thanks very much for having me.
Great. I don't know if you got a chance to hear much of what we've been talking about so far. Have you heard any of our discussion so far?
I just caught the last bit there about how institutions can serve people well, assuming that they were a member of that institution in the past.
Okay. Well, tell you what, Kathy, I'm interested in the work you do, and just kind of introduce how your training, your education, your life experience enters into this discussion about secular rituals and the creation of ritual.
Sure, absolutely. So I work in the Life Design Lab at Stanford, and here we are thinking a lot about how to use innovation processes to establish behaviors that help you build a life where you thrive. And so in a lot of cases, what we're looking at is the space before the rituals are created. We're really thinking about how do you get unstuck from problem solving, and then how do you create behaviors for yourself that might become rituals that will help you flourish.
Okay. I hear the title of Design Lab, Life Design Lab, I think some people might think of some type of technology. But help us understand a little bit more about just define those terms and how they apply to ritual.
Sure. So the Life Design Lab at Stanford is really thinking about this process of applying design thinking, which is an innovation process, okay. to the process of designing who we are and who we want to become. And so as you might imagine, this process of having rituals in one's life, having practices that they follow, on a daily process or on a weekly process or a monthly process, that process of developing those practices is partly what we're about. So you can imagine that if you are thinking about who you are and who you want to become, you might be at times stuck, having trouble, having problems in your life or in your work, and we're really thinking about applying innovation to that process. So design thinking is an innovation process sets up a framework, essentially, for people.
Sure. Yeltia, just I'm curious about your take on when we looking at ritual and applying that to life and ritual as a way to help either with problem solving or other issues. Is that kind of a modern, do you see that as a natural modern adaption of early, perhaps more ancient ritual?
I would say that ritual can be therapeutic, but it's not therapy.
Sure.
Just like it's artistic, but it's not art. And it's a question part of intentionality. What's behind the practice? It's a quality of mind somehow. that can be directed towards an object or an objective or a state of affairs. I wouldn't see it. I don't see ritual practice today as being something that's a tool, as it were. It's a behavior. It's okay. a spectrum of ritual, like a spectrum of rich, of human behavior.
Sure. You know, we're starting to get some calls, people who want to contribute their perspectives and their experiences to the conversation. We had a caller, and I'm going to read you what this caller had to say and then and ask you to respond. We had a call from Ron in St. Paul. He said he was curious about rituals and superstitions. How tied are those, and how do they fit into rituals? So, Yeltia, about the question of the difference between superstition and ritual.
Well, if you think about it, if you think about the witches in the Middle Ages, for example, they were accused of superstition. But in fact, it was because their ceremonies or their use of herbs and other things to heal people were not considered kosher by the institutions. And so I would say it's those are rituals that fall into the perhaps informal or private sphere rather than the formal or the public official sphere. And so one way of making a them and us sort of distinction is to say that they're superstition. It's a way of qualifying or disqualifying, actually, some sort of behavior or practice.
Sure. We've got a caller here from calling us from Fargo. This is Maria. Maria, how would you describe your experience with ritual?
Hi, good morning. I was going to say, I actually grew up in Europe, or more specifically Russia, in kind of my formative elementary years. And the one difference I noticed when we moved is a lot of the rituals, and it may be more so kind of the modern times, in this country is surrounded by, you know, like, for example, Black Friday, money, gifts, you know, being surrounded by materialistic items, whereas I think in Europe it's more tradition of getting together, maybe not necessarily even family, but spending time together in a more of a consistent basis. So birthdays are a big deal, not so much emphasis on the giving, but more of the, you know, celebrating and the, you know, kind of eating together and more celebration of life. Sure. Versus possessions.
Yeah, interesting. And I have to imagine that a lot of, I don't want to imagine. I'll put the question, Yeltia, and I don't know if I have not had a chance to read your book. I'm sorry, but I wonder if it's something that you touch on, is the ritual serving a purpose of helping people connect to something that has less to do with acquiring possessions and material things, and connecting with family, community, and others.
Yes, I think that's very true. It's about authenticity. It's about meaningfulness, and if one's beliefs and practice is institutional or tied to a religion, that institutional religion, it's going to definitely be along those lines. When you're not involved in that kind of a setting, it's more difficult in some ways because you have to create your own. You have to identify them yourself. And what the person who, if I can follow up on what she just said about the difference in Europe, is that between actually a consumerist approach to ritual and a more authentic or down to earth, I don't know which we'd call it.
Sure.
But I was recently interviewed by a magazine called DNA in Paris, and they are the think tank for the marketing industry.
Oh.
And they did a whole issue on ritual, which looked like a really fancy modeling book or a magazine, really heavy with glossy photos and things like that, which I thought was interesting because it's not just related to North America. It's also hit Europe as well.
Yeah, interesting. If you're just tuning in, I'm Brant Williams. I'm sitting in for Carrie Miller. This hour, we are talking about secular rituals with my guests, Yeltia Gordon-Lennox. And we also spoken earlier with Kathy Davis from Stanford University. We're going to bring another person into our conversation who is calling in, Isabel Russo. She is the head of ceremonies for Humanist UK, and she's joining us from the UK. Isabel, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Hello, Brent.
Hey.
Hello, Jelke.
Are you familiar with each other?
Good to hear you.
yes, colleague.
Oh, that's nice to know.
A lot of water and distance. We're colleagues.
Well, that's great. Well, Isabel, let me bring you into this conversation as we talk about, obviously, I think a lot of people think of the ritual itself as being obviously part of established religious tradition, and we're talking about secular ritual. Give me your sense of the role of secular ritual in, especially in Europe, because that's one of the things that I think a lot of people are going to be kind of bringing the differences between how we approach this in America and in Europe.
I mean, talking specifically from my position as head of ceremonies at Humanist UK, we're a charity that's been representing non-religious people for over 100 years. And essentially, the framework that we kind of broke was the traditional one, one that was very much centered on a ritual being about a god or gods. And we recognized the growing but unarticulated need for ritual for people who didn't have that belief system. And have been providing ceremonies ever since. Even in the last 10 years, I think there's been a kind of explosion in the desire for people to have non-religious ritual as more and more people feel more confident about expressing themselves as living a non-religious life. But actually, I think the interesting thing also is that they don't want to express it as living a non-religious life, because that's defining themselves by something that they're not. It's about living a life that actually has profound meaning and has philosophical resonance. And ritual, non-religious ritual, is very much a part of that.
Sure. Well, I have to imagine that perhaps, and correct me if I'm wrong, it might be useful to have a secular ritual that is necessarily, it's secular because there may be people participating who have different religious traditions, and you don't want to step on or disrespect any of those particular religious traditions. I'm wondering if you're seeing that as maybe a part of why some people are also incorporating more of a secular angle to their ritual.
Yes, very much so. And we're seeing, again, increasingly more people coming to us from different belief systems. I guess when they come to us, it's more likely that they'll hold those beliefs culturally, but not actually as a practice. But still, the symbols from the beliefs that they grew up with or you know, grew into as a family, were born into, hold great significance and meaning to them, even if they, you know, they don't resonate with a practiced belief. It's still part of their cultural identity. And so part of our creative process is creating a ceremony that entwines those beliefs, those rituals from different cultures, and creates something that has significance and meaning to, well, within a wedding, to the couple and to those people watching them. And also, yes, it's an inclusive environment. So whilst the ceremony is non-religious, or in my case, it's humanist, we always very much work hard to create a space in which everyone, whatever their belief system, feels included and feels that there's time for them to acknowledge that belief system, whether it's through a period of reflection or something like that.
Yeah, I'm interested in more of our callers contributing there. Maybe you have your own ritual that you've created for your loved ones, for family, your community. Give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. You can also send me a tweet on Twitter at BrantMPR. Yeltia, I want to ask you about the idea of religion and when it comes to ceremonies like funerals and marriages. Actually, let's focus on funerals. Cremation and spreading ashes of the deceased, is that considered would that be considered a secular ritual?
Of course, but there's no need to be religious to do that. There are legal impediments sometimes, but it's not a religious. It's not particularly religious.
Sure. I'm wondering if we've seen, historically speaking, if there was a time when we saw this as being maybe it grew out of some necessity and it became ritual. I'm wondering if there's some historical context to that as well.
Well, in the United States, for example, in 1960s, only 4% of the population was going for cremation. And now it's gone up to high levels. I think I read somewhere that in 2035, they expect it to be like 80% of people who will be cremated. And with the frequency of a kind of a practice, there are rituals that go with it or that are developed around it to make it more meaningful or to make it feel, to have a sense. Like when you see a coffin going into the ground and the dirt falling on top of it and you hear that sound, you smell the earth, it's a multisensory experience. When you're sitting there with a urn full of ashes that are rather sterilized, it's more difficult to say, how can I really feel like this person and this person has gone, that I no longer have the same relationship with this person anymore.
Yeah.
Can I just interject?
Isabel. Yeah.
It's interesting. In England, I think we're kind of playing catch up in terms of legislation, in terms of the rising popularity of cremation and spreading of ashes. And I think it's interesting to note that really it's only in the last probably 50 years or something where Christianity has loosened a sense that actually a scattering of the ashes is against their code, because there was a sense that cremation really wasn't necessarily the Christian way forward, because of a sense of dismembering the body. And so now, as that's become interpreted differently, people across different belief systems feel more comfortable about the concept of cremation. And it's interesting that they're starting. I mean, actually, it's unlegislated for, so people are quite confused about where they can scatter ashes and where they can't. And again, as Yeltsin was saying, it's not a ritual that is within the domain of any particular belief system. Sure. And increasingly, people want to scatter ashes in places that have heart and meaning to them. And I think we're just starting to create legislation about, you know, whether or not you can scatter ashes at sea, or what the depth has to be or not be. But it's interesting that. You know, the law is playing catch up with actually the human desire to have ritual around that.
Yeah, as it does in many areas. That was Isabel Russo. She's one of our guests this morning as we talk about secular rituals. And I'm looking also for our callers and right, just give us some more ideas. Some of the things that you do, maybe it's some type of secular ritual that you've created. And perhaps you're somebody who's looking for a way to create your own ritual. To mark a particular occasion in your life, and you don't want to do it in a way that involves a big religious dogma. We're going to take a little break for news, but we're going to be back and we're going to talk more with our guests. And we'll also take your calls at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. But right now, some news with Mike Moen.
Good morning. At least 30 civilians were killed along with 16 Taliban fighters as Afghan government forces battled insurgents in southern Helmand province overnight. That's according to provincial officials. They say in the eastern part of the capital, Taliban insurgents staged a coordinated attack against security forces when a suicide bomber detonated his explosives and fighters then engaged them in a gun battle. Ivanka Trump is defending her use of a private email account as she was moving into an advisor's position in her father's administration. President Trump's daughter told ABC News that using a private email account can't be compared to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server. Ivanka Trump says her emails were archived and contained no classified information. President Trump's administration is threatening to veto a Senate resolution that would halt U.S. involvement in the Saudi-led war in Yemen. The White House issued the veto threat as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Defense Secretary James Mattis were on Capitol Hill today. They were briefing senators who are increasingly uneasy with the U.S. response to Saudi Arabia after the killing of a Saudi journalist in Turkey. The Senate is considering a vote on the resolution as soon as today. And Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell says he's pleased with the state of the U.S. economy, but cautions that some forms of corporate debt have reached risky levels. At the same time, Powell says the financial system and markets appear far sturdier than they did before the 2008 crisis. In a speech today to the Economic Club of New York, Powell said the Fed is monitoring potential vulnerabilities in the banking system to ensure its continued stability. In the Twin Cities right now, 28 degrees. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 11:33.
Programming is supported by McKnight Foundation, driving sustainable solutions to help the Midwest be a leader in advancing a clean energy economy. Online at McKnight.org.
On the next NPR News Presents, Minnesota native and investigative reporter Bethany McLean talks about her new book, Saudi America, The Truth About Fracking and How It's Changing the World. Hear her today at noon and 9 p.m.
Welcome back to our conversation. My name is Brant Williams. I'm sitting in for Carrie Miller. This hour, we're talking about secular rituals. I have several guests with me this morning. We have Yeltia Gordon-Lennox and Isabel Russo, and we also have Kathy Davies. She's a lecturer and managing director of Life Design Lab at Stanford University. And we have a listener who had left us a question for Kathy. And so, Kathy, I want to put that to you. If you're still with us, I hope you still are.
Yes, I'm still here.
Great, thank you. This is a question from Jane from Rochester. She says, I have a question for Kathy. How would I develop a system or a ritual to help me with a problem in my life? For example, I have a hard time waking up in the morning. How can I design my way out of this problem?
Fantastic. So what we like to think about is this process of really understanding from a human-centered perspective, what is the root of the problem? So we call that just having empathy for oneself. So I might ask you some questions about, what keeps you from waking up? Are there particular things that make it difficult? So we really understand your values and needs there. And then come up with lots of ideas. How would we possibly solve this problem? And then we would try some things, prototype, put some things into practice and see how they go over the course of a couple of days or weeks, and then make changes from there. So it's really an iterative process. And then once you find something that feels like it's working, then you set that and generate a practice around it. So in some cases, like waking up in the morning, maybe you need to recruit some help. Maybe you want to use technology. Maybe you want to set up some rituals around going to bed, actually, so that you are energized and able to get up easily.
Is that the same as, I mean, it almost sounds like we're talking about developing habits. And I want to make sure that I'm clear on if we aren't just talking about, you know, if you just make a habit, set yourself a reminder around 9:30 every night just to, hey, start brushing your teeth and getting ready for bed. What would your difference between calling this a ritual and a habit?
For me, I think the difference, and I'm not an expert in ritual by any means. What I'm really an expert in is this process of innovation and trying to create practices. So for me, I think the difference between ritual and habit is really the intention behind it. So if it is something that has some particular meaning to you that you do on a regular basis or that you do to mark a particular event, to me, that feels like it can become a ritual.
Oh, okay.
Yeltia, I would love to hear from the other guests about what they see as those differences.
Well, let me start with Yeltia. The difference between habit and ritual, is it that ritual just has more a different level of meaning to you than just a habit?
I would agree with Kathy in the sense that there's a question of intentionality, that there's a question that the intention behind the act will make it feel like a ritual. Whether it's a habit or whether it's a routine or whether it's a ceremony, it's in the spectrum of ritual activity, a spectrum that goes from the formal or the public to the informal or the private. Excuse me, someone.
That's okay. I got a call.
I've got my backup phone is.
She's not in the habit of turning her phone off.
Yeah. Can form a ritual to.
Phone. Yes, calling to remind herself.
Backup phone.
Gotcha.
To come back to a spectrum of ritual activity, that habit is a part of the spectrum, and what defines it perhaps as a habit is just like a mindless.
Sure.
We used to think of ritual as mindless actions.
Right.
And now there's a tendency, like Kathy's talking about, where habits or ritual becomes something that has an intention behind it, and that's what gives it the force.
Yeah.
That's
Isabel, does that sound about right to you?
That's what makes it efficient.
Yes, that absolutely. As Yeltia says, habit is mindless. Like I drive home, and I'm home without even realizing that I've driven, and yet it is a habit. I do it every day. Same with brushing my teeth. But ritual is about very intentionally bringing your conscious mind to every moment. And it's that sense where time pauses. It's time out of time. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And you're very conscious of each of those stages.
Right. We have some, actually, we're having some folks who are calling us in who have something to contribute to the conversation. Let's go to Carol from Green Bay. Carol, what's your question or comment this morning?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I actually used to live in St. Paul for the last 25 years and was a professor at the University of St. Thomas. And my entire line of research has been on ritual as it can help us create stronger cultures in our marriages, in our friendships, and in our family. And so I'm so glad you're having this conversation. And the one thing I was hoping to add was one of the ways that we in the communication discipline, my PhD is in interpersonal and family communication, one of the ways that we define ritual interpersonally is any repetitive act that pays homage to something that is sacred, such as a person, a relationship, an object, or an event. And I loved your discussion about what, you know, turns a habit into a ritual. And I think it's so important for us to think about the ways that we're imbuing meaning into our relationships, because sure, we know from all the research that this is what creates strong and long-lasting relationships, when we can create those strong cultures,
right,
with the people that we adore and love.
Thank you, Carol. That was, let me get to Yeltia. What do you think when you hear Carol's contribution here?
I think that it corresponds to her experience of ritual. I think that the idea of repetition being part of what is considered ritual, if you look at a historical view, that's exactly what it was. It was ceremonial, repetitive, like lighting candles, saying certain prayers, and related to religious context. Then with the Beat Generation came along, the hippies and the beatniks, and it suddenly became spontaneity. The criteria were totally different. Improvisation, it was direct experience, immediacy. Those were all priorities for ritual in the 50s and the 60s. Flower power.
Yeah.
Then I think as we've moved along, I would say we're in an era now of ritual power, where we feel the power of ritual. We feel that there's a difference when there's intentionality behind a gesture, whether it's a habit or whether it's a ceremony. And
right,
when it's fitting, when it means something, and when it feels authentic, there's a certain power there that it's a bit amazing to us because we're not used to seeing it outside of perhaps ritual contexts.
Right. And, you know, I'm getting to that point, I'm getting some response to my queries from folks on Twitter, and I'm going to read you, this is from Angela, who tweeted me. She said, would someone please speak about folks like me who grew up in a religious family but now live a secular life? For example, I've kept some of my Christmas rituals, and I plan to inter my mom's remains, but I'm not a practicing Christian. Is that how innate our need is? Isabel, let me put that to you. What would you say to Angela?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, people often say to us, to humanists, you know, why do you celebrate Christmas? It's a religious festival, but there are pagan festivals that predated Christmas, which speak to the human desire to mark that time in the cycle of the year. You know, where certainly in England, it's very dark, it's very cold. You need to be reminded of the importance of community, of family, of feasting, of warmth, of sharing. And we ritualize that and have ritualized that from the very beginning. So for Angela, she's on a journey of, as I mentioned before, in marrying people who have cultural religious identities, she's on the journey of finding, of retaining those things that have heart and meaning to her from her childhood and from the things that influenced her as she grew up, but also of kind of shaking them clean for herself and making sure that they're authentic to who she is now. So whether that's adding new elements or retaining some things but cutting away other things, you know, that's her own personal journey. And it's so instinctive as well. She must trust, and it sounds like she is, she must trust her instincts to guide her to what has meaning for her.
And we have another caller who has something to say along those lines as well. Let me get to the caller first, and then we'll get some more comments. We have John in Minneapolis. John, what's your question or comment about the subject?
Good morning. Yeah, it piggybacks off of the caller that was raised in a religious tradition and is now secular.
Hello, John.
Hello, John.
I think we've lost John here. I'm sorry. I think, Yeltia, you wanted to respond to Angela's comment about being raised religiously and now living a secular life.
I was actually going to jump in, too. So actually, after Yeltia, I'd love to say something.
Oh, I'm sorry, Kathy. Maybe that was you.
It may have been.
Okay.
I was wanting to jump in because I see... go ahead.
I'm sorry, I'm not doing a good job of being a traffic cop here. Let's start with Yeltia. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say that, that there's a Belgian scholar named Becha Mesquita de Gomez, and she's done a lot of work on what she calls emotion acculturalization. And it talks about what Angela's talking about with becoming, going from a religious background into feeling they're more comfortable in secular settings. And it's something that sort of happens, some of us, or you're raised in a certain area. But if you move from the rural area to an urban area, or if you move from one culture to another, your rituals become different. Your system of your behavior becomes different. You
sure.
Maybe talk with a different accent sometimes.
It's
things change. It's not static.
Sure. And Kathy, I'm sorry, what did you want to respond to?
Yeah,
Angela's
I wanted
well?
To jump in too, because I think that we are all really looking for meaning. And what we have seen over time is people had rituals, had practices around religious institutions. And since that is perhaps changing for a lot of folks, like the caller, Angela, people are still looking, though, for those frameworks of meaning. And so when we think about the work that we do with Designing Your Life, we spend a lot of time trying to help people be intentional about their point of view and think about what does work mean to them and what does life mean to them, what are their philosophies, perhaps outside of the structures of formal institutions. And so that then allows people to create behaviors, practices, and connections with others that are meaningful to them based on what they have written down for themselves.
Sure.
But I completely agree with Yeltia and Isabel that this process of looking for meaning is really fundamental and foundational to who we are as humans.
Yeah, it seems like perhaps we are hardwired for this, human beings, to be able to. I mean, we do seek meaning in all types of things, and I wonder if it'd be fair to say that rituals and other one of these ways that we seek to find meaning in all types of things. Would that be a fair assessment to you, Kathy?
Oh, I think so, absolutely. And I think that's actually why for secular folks, something like what we do, this process of life design, it's enough of a framework that people feel held in it and enough freedom that they don't feel caught in some stricture in which they no longer believe or something that's changing. So I completely agree.
Sure. We have another Twitter comment. This is from Miss Frizzle for Life. She writes, I'm not particularly adept at rituals, but I find sports rituals to be interesting to observe. I'm not sure if it's because I find them silly or just curious. And she'd be interested to hear our guest's take on sports rituals. Would either any of you like to take on sports ritual? How about Isabel?
Oh, no. This is a very unsporty person. But, I mean, I suppose what of interest can I say on this? I think it touches on certainly a sense of patriotism. You know, ritual is designed around strong feelings and feelings of belonging or feelings of loss. So nationalism or patriotism is strongly reflected in those sports rituals. I suppose I think of the opening ceremonies of, you know, big football matches, rugby matches, particularly thinking of the All Blacks doing the haka.
Yes.
It's a huge expression of their identity and their national pride, which is very ritualistic and speaks to the heart of what, you know, ritual is about, which again is questions of identity and passion.
Right. And there are other, and I'm also curious to talk to you, and I think we've kind of touched on this a little bit, of talking about micro rituals. I've had other responses, folks who've written into me via Twitter and other ways of describing what they consider micro rituals, such as, you know, getting up in the morning, putting on the pot of coffee, emptying the dishwasher, getting some water while the coffee is going, playing a video game or perhaps watching a program, picking up the paper. What are some other examples that you would consider these to be these micro rituals? And Yelty.
Micro rituals.
Yeah, micro rituals. It's not easy to say, actually. I'm sorry.
Well, I think ritual, it's a biological need, and we use it to adapt to different situations. There's a need to do something when something bad happens. In particular, we have there's this sort of compelling need to do something, and this is a biological need. Some keeping busy when you're nervous, for example, it addresses a need, a profound need to do something. So this would be a micro ritual. Maybe knitting would be a micro ritual if the intention behind it is to help you calm your nervousness, for example, or your anxiety about a child that's not home yet. I guess that would be a micro ritual, one example of a micro ritual. The other rituals that we do our biological need to feel safe. Kathy talked about doing things in a particular setting. Place and setting that feels safe is essential to the effect of ritual. Also, context or situation, whether it's the people around us, the need to contain strong emotion. And this is also a function of ritual, where it's adaptive.
Right. Do you think that rituals...
Can I just...
Yeah, go ahead, Isabel.
Well,
yeah.
Just to add, I mean, I think it's interesting in that one person could be emptying a dishwasher and its habit, or just a chore, and another person could be emptying a dishwasher and it is a ritual. Hmm. And the difference is on your intention and on your conscious engagement with the job in hand. And I think that's kind of key, really, to starting to unpack what ritual really is. So, for instance, putting on makeup can just be a habit or just something that you have to do. But if you're putting on makeup really in staying in the present moment, looking at your face, thinking about your presentation to the world, thinking about, you know, what that means, thinking about thoughts about identity, because ritual, as I've already said, has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And certainly with putting on makeup, there is a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that could actually be a very ritualistic thing, depending on the conscious intention that you're bringing to that activity. But also, you can do it in a completely mindless way.
And yes, thank you for that. And again, with some of the things that people have been contributing here online, it sounds like people are finding meaning in doing these things. That it's not
That's
just
it.
Doing a having a dinner with the neighbors is not just a dinner with the neighbors. It's a way to celebrate their friendships, their relationships. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me that would take that to the level of being a ritual and not just a little tradition that you do or just something. It's Sunday night dinner. It's something a little bit more than that.
And it's interesting the time frame on that, because a ritual doesn't have to be half an hour or an hour. That thing of gathering people together to have a meal, that moment when you just sit and look at the food, or that moment when somebody cuts the pie or cuts the cake, that moment where there's just a breath, that is a moment of ritual as far as I'm concerned.
Hmm. We have another, we have some comments also from callers. This from Maggie. She said, as a kid, I always begged my mom to start a family tradition, but she's the type of person who loves to make things up as they go. She goes, but hearing this conversation makes me feel validated in my desire to have some sort of ritual. And she asks, what is it about the human psyche that seeks that out? Yeltia.
Well, I would come back to the what you call an adaptive. It makes us feel safe, and to do something. It also marks time and space. For example, just lifting a glass and toasting someone who just turned 50. It's a way of it's a micro ritual, but it's also a way of saying it. We remember we were at this particular place, this restaurant, we drank this wine, and we toasted my 50th birthday. It marks a time and space. There's a real social communal aspect that's that's important as well, when particularly in those kinds of micro rituals. It doesn't have to be long. No one even has to say anything, but it's been marked.
Does it matter how many people are present? Does it matter? Does there have to be music? Does there have to be food involved? I always wonder. I mean, I think people get the idea that a ritual has to have a bunch of people or more people. It can't be just one person, and there has to be some sort of libation involved. But it doesn't sound like that's the case, right?
For me, no. I think the context is very, very different from different situations. What I would say is that when a ritual is performed alone, there is what part of the intentionality is to connect it with other people, even in your mind. For example, someone who's burying their dog, for example, the dog is somehow present, and also the other people who enjoyed the company of this dog is present. There's a sense of community, even if the person is not immediately surrounded by others.
Right.
And that point of people, I mean, I agree with the LTA in that ritual can be undertaken alone, but it is quite a significant part of ritual generally that there is somebody at least who bears witness, and having that witness born is quite a necessary ingredient. And again, with non-religious ritual, I think that's really interesting, the step away from regarding God as bearing witness to actually regarding your family and your friends and your community as being those that bear witness, and through bearing witness are the proof that it's true, that this thing has happened.
Right. We have a question for Kathy from one of our listeners. Our listener asks, what advice do you give to people who need the courage to change and do things differently than they've always done before, whether that's changing the way they come into work in the morning or change the way they celebrate the birth of a child?
I think that it is true. We've been talking about how people like stability and like to have a feeling of belonging. But we know also that the world is constantly changing around us. And so I think in some ways there's some comfort in realizing that whether or not you want to change, things will change. And so developing some behaviors or some tries at something can be met with a sense of adventure instead of a sense of trepidation or fear. And so if we're able to reframe that process of change as, hey, I'm just going to give this a go for a short period, it doesn't have to become a practice yet. It'll just be something that I try for the moment. And then as I see how that goes, I can settle in. I think that's the advice I would give, is take it a step at a time.
Yeah. You know, another question that I'm curious about is, as more people are kind of describing themselves as being non-affiliated with any particular religious tradition, but there's still a lot of people who... I get the feeling there's a lot of folks who still embrace, they still go to churches because they like the ritual that goes along with a church service. And I'm wondering, Isabel, if you're seeing that there's a number of people who would maybe consider themselves culturally religious, but maybe they don't necessarily believe in God, but they still go to church and they participate in the ritual because it brings them meaning.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, people go to church often, not, as you say, not necessarily because they're going for an active worship, but because they really respond to that, well, to the habit or to the ritual of going, because it's what they grew up with, but also that sense of community. I mean, being with other people, sitting together, listening to what is often beautiful and meaningful text, whether you're religious or not, and music, all of those things have great value. And I really liked the question from the lady who asked about how can we redefine ritual for ourselves? What's the advice? And I think it is about the courage to change, the courage to look at what you grew up with and whether that's still resonant to you, and then reinterpreting it for yourself. So we come up against a lot of couples coming to us who say our parents so want us to get married in a church, and we like the church, but it just, there's something just not quite right for us. And I think I really admire those couples because they're willing to stand in their own selves and say to their nearest and dearest, you know what, that was right for you, but it wasn't right for me, and we're trying to find out what is right for us.
Right. Well, Isabel Russo, thank you so much for being a part of our conversation. We're going to start to wrap things up here. Isabel Russo is the head of ceremonies for Humanist UK. And we also heard from Kathy Davies. She's a lecturer and managing director of Life Design Lab at Stanford University in Fremont, California. And you also heard from Yeltia Gordon-Lennox. She's a psychotherapist and author of Crafting Secular Ritual, A Practical Guide. Thank you all for joining us, and thank you for your calls and your tweets. My name's Brant Williams.
Programming is supported by Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge's 11th Annual Christmas Concert featuring Jason Gray, sharing stories of songs and hope on Saturday, December 15th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. at Grace Church in Eden Prairie. Tickets are available now.
NPR News doesn't just deliver the headlines. We help you understand new perspectives.
We have so much more in common with one another than separate from one another.
And I've learned from listening to this station that people are calling in and they're more eclectic. There's a lot more moderation.
A lot of people who voted differently than I did so because they want to solve the same problems that I want to solve. We're going about it a different way.
NPR News. Discover what